We've been looking at this text called the Discourse on Loving Kindness, or the Metta Sutta. Metta is a word in the Pali language, the early Buddhist texts. It translates as friendliness or loving kindness. Sometimes I'll just say love, although there's a separate word for kind of juicy love. The parallel can be made to the two Greek words, eros, for the kind of personal or enraptured or erotic love, sensual love, and agape for the universal or impersonal love. And so this is the agape form of love. And we see it in the text that the invocation is, you know, is to shine it out in all directions impartially, to radiate this quality over the entire world. So we've been looking at the text for the last few weeks. We looked at the opening of this text that talks about the basic disciplines of spiritual practice, skill in goodness, and kind of qualities of carrying ourselves in the world, able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented, easily satisfied. And of course, these are not just like qualities to practice, but they are results of practice, and they are processes in themselves. If it was easy to just say, let me be content and easily satisfied, the spiritual path would be quite short. It would start with somebody saying, how about being content and easily satisfied? And then you going, okay. And then being contented and easily satisfied for the rest of your life. And that's about all it is, really. Once there's contentment and easy satisfaction, part of what this means, actually, in a deep way and in a physiological way, is that there's the sense of being safe in the world, that the excitements of the world don't pull me off center, and the threats or dangers of the world don't terrify me off my center. And that's a profound balance in the heart that spiritual practice can lead us toward, but which can feel quite elusive as we are when we are young in practice. And young in practice and young in years aren't related, so you can be young in practice for a very long time, and you can be quite mature in practice very early. Footnote, former lives, etc., different conversation. But it really does seem like some people just kind of understand the world deeply very young, and others maintain a kind of, you know, stubborn delusion long into their elder years. Who knows how that works? The text starts with these qualities of the spiritual life in a very broad way, and moves on into the specific practices that are the foundation of the path, namely the ethical practices. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. And this hints at the practice of clarifying our actions. And we talked about how that phrase, that the wise would later reprove, links the ethical practice into community and the presence of elders, actually. The presence of an intergenerational or not just peer community, that it's a deep and appropriate part of spiritual life to be embedded in a broad community of folks who are practicing. In the Buddhist tradition, this community is called Sangha. In some of the yoga traditions, it's called Sangha or Kula, which means family. And then we get the core practice itself, which is a wish for well-being in a deeply impartial way. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. The great and the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be at ease. And we talked last week a bunch about this phrase, omitting none, and what it might mean to omit none from the wish that all beings might be at ease. And we talked about unpopular political figures and difficult people in our own lives, people that have harmed us. We talked about what forgiveness might mean in the context of this practice. Like, there are folks who do wrong in this world, who harm others, who harm themselves, who harm us. What would it mean to see that clearly and hold clear boundaries and even not forgive a person's harmful actions, but still hold them within this wish that they might find peace or ease? And we talked about whether it was okay to, you know, to wish that someone would become happy and liberated, mostly because they would stop doing the stupid things that they are doing. And I waffled a little bit and ended up saying that I think that's okay, at least, you know, partially, to you know, love people with a slight agenda. I love you unconditionally, but it would be great if you did things a little better. And I don't even know if I need to pass judgment on that or not, but it's just true. It just happens, right? Our intentions are very often mixed, very, very often mixed. And so a whole layer of self-acceptance in that becomes possible. And I think it's important to say that, you know, the text and this teaching, this body of teachings, proposes this thing that is pretty radical. You know, love all living beings without exception. But the reality of that, of course, is that as long as I think of myself as a separate being, I think of others as separate beings, there is inevitably this quality of preference. So preference arises as soon as there is difference. And so, you know, if you go to someone's house and they're like, you know, hey, you know, I made these cookies here. And you're like, wow, that's so awesome. They're lovely. There's only one kind of cookie. And you're just like, I'm being given a cookie. It's fabulous. But if someone says, hey, welcome to my house. I'm a cookie master. I love making cookies. And I have made three different kinds of cookies, right? I've made pecan cookies, and I've made thumbprint cookies, and I've made coconut cookies. Which one would you like? And suddenly you're like, whoa, difference, right? And then the mind immediately does this comparing. Do I want a thumbprint, a jam cookie? Those are good, but I really like coconut cookies. What if I like these? Which one? And you might ask them, which one should I take? And, you know, can I have one of all of them? And it's not about whether or not you should. Of course, you should take one of each one. That's the polite thing to do. But the point here is not actually what you should do ethically. Maybe that's embedded in a discussion about preference and difference. The point is that as soon as there is difference within a class of things, automatically our mind, heart, creates preference. It's how we order the world. So you go around the world and you're like, these people are more like me, these people are more unlike me. And there's an instinct to be like, therefore, I like the ones that are more like me, I feel safe with them, I feel unsafe with the ones that are less like me. And that can polarize very deeply as we see. But it's just built into the nature of phenomena. And in a sense, this is built into what we could call the appearance of the world of duality from the absolute or non-dual. In some traditions, there's a willful being that creates everything, that creates difference out of a primal unity. In other traditions, difference just unfolds based on karma and conditions on its own. It's all part of one vast unified system, but things appear different from each other. But in both cases, the presence of difference implies the presence of preference, of judgment, of analysis, and the presence of the self. As soon as there's multiple things, you are different from something else. And so the perception of difference is also embedded in the perception of having a self. I know who I am once I know that I'm not someone else. And it's amazing to see this happen in a newborn infant. Right? That in the beginning they're just this they seem to be just this fully sensate creature. And even when they meet your eyes, kind of in those first couple weeks, it's they're in what you could call a merged state, right? They're not actually thinking, I'm the little baby, and there's my papa or my mama or whatever. But differentiation develops, and over those first kind of handful of weeks, this little being starts to separate, or we could say reality through the consciousness of that being starts to bifurcate from an undivided union of just like oscillation of light and dark and, you know, milk and sleep, and just kind of these no words for the oscillation of things that's happening, to suddenly like, I'm here and the Milky is there. Right? That's the and they say this is the first thing that babies' eyes focus on. Our eyes learn to focus initially at a distance of about 20 inches, which is the distance from the nipple to the eyes. So the baby is nursing, looks up and sees mama, and that's the first focus. And that's the first differentiation, is the first like, oh, this is me and this is mama. Right? And as soon as that happened, I was all interested in watching that happen and being like, okay, there it is. That first little bit of, I want this, right? And now, almost 2 years later, it's wildly complex and really exciting to watch that happen. But it's the same thing, really, that like out of an undifferentiated field, like there was the time when he would just eat anything we put in front of him. Now it's all differentiation, right? I want that, I don't want that. Today I wanted that, but 5 minutes later I don't want it, you know. I want it, but I want to do things with it. I want to throw it, I want to, you know. And it's like what was once a single thing differentiates into a whole bunch of different things, and with it comes preference. So what we see then in this wish to omit none is this profound transcendent a little bit or deeply re-embodying practice of remembering or restoring to our heart the quality of union, of non-separateness. There's actually no way to omit none, to love all beings equally, if you maintain the stance of a separate self. As soon as I'm me, it's impossible to not divide the world of beings into ones I prefer and ones I prefer less. If I'm doing the practice of dissolving those preferences into a vast field of unified loving everything, I have to include myself in that. There's no way to hold yourself separate from that and be like, I love everyone impartially, but here I am, this isolated individual. Because at the very least, your system is going to then go, well, there's all of those vast beings, but here I am alone. And I'm, again, going to create a separation. And so to do the omitting none practice implies, and this is where the text is going to go in its last lines, implies that the sense of a separate, isolated, alone, differentiated individual is going to have to dissolve at some point. And this has implications. So we get this verse that says, here's the practice, omit none, love all beings, send the wish, may all beings be at ease, omitting none. And then the first implication of that comes out. So the next line, the line that we haven't gotten to yet, is this one. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. And this is really the inevitable result of differentiation is one of the inevitable results of differentiation. There's others. This is the painful one. As soon as there's difference, which means preference, judgment, analysis, etc., that means there is ill will, anger, hatred, fear as the corollary. Right? As soon as there's two different cookies, and I like one and I don't like the other one quite as much, there's some way that there's the possibility, right? Somebody grabs the one I like, and I only have the one I didn't like, anger. And that was mine. The toddler is now saying, mine. I'm like, wow, where did you learn that? We don't say that. I'm like, you're not allowed to say that, right? The toys belong to everybody. Stupid parents. When I'm more in my right mind, I'm like, yeah, this is yours. That thing is yours. You know, which really means it's mine because I'm dad, your dad, you know. But it's appropriate, right? And, oh, that's mine is showing up. But, of course, the corollary to mine is when the other toddler comes and is like, it's like, no, that's mine, and conflict. And it just starts. So the first one listed is deception. Let none deceive another. Deception is one of the deep, painful human tricks or qualities or wounds or hell realms in some way that based in this quality of differentiation and the fear and scarcity and wanting that it gives rise to, one of the standard maneuvers that humans do, and some animals, but mostly humans, is to deceive others, is to lie or manipulate someone else's experience such that I get more of what I want. My baby has learned deception. Fortunately, just in a funny way to start with, but I know where it's going. This was the first joke that he figured out on his own, and he totally figured this was his like inborn natural humor. Was this? He would take a fork full of food, and he had gotten into feeding us. He would feed us. He'll feed you your entire bowl of food. He wants to put it in your mouth. So he would do that. He would pick up a fork full of food. He would offer it to you. You would lean in, and right before your mouth got to it, he would go, pull it back and eat it himself. And then he would get this little smile like, I got you. And of course, he would be like, oh, you got me. Oh, my God. And he would stick the fork, and he'd be like, and you're like, and he goes. So this little trickery. Why is it funny? First of all, I was like, "Oh, why is that funny? You made that up, and you know it's funny, right?" So there's something that starts where, like, oh, the mind realizes that you can kind of manipulate another person's experience, and of course, this can turn dark in all sorts of ways, as it does. I was a liar as a child, when I was between the ages of like 8 and 13 or so. I was really a bad liar. I stole things and I lied about it. I stole stuff from my friends. And when I was caught, I just lied and said I hadn't done it, even though it was obvious. And feeling back on it, it was such a painful time that I was just like doing this thing kind of defensively in a way. But it comes from, you know, insecurity, from the feeling of not being safe, from wanting or grasping or scarcity, filling the heart. And so to recover from this, again, the process of cultivating this universal kindness or friendliness or love absolutely means that we have to recover from the implications of difference. that are deception, hatred, fear, hostility. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. The despising is really poignant. Despising any being in any state. And that's a beautiful way, I think, of reminding us that very often when we despise someone, it's a harsh word in a certain way, when we look down on someone, when we despise is kind of like hate them for being who they are, kind of. You know, oh, I despise you or that or something. That part of what we're doing is we're conflating the being and their actions and their condition, their state. So someone might be, you know, really wounded, traumatized. Someone perhaps was profoundly abused as a child, and as an adult is kind of mean or bitter or kind of vile. And there are these folks, and those are folks that you might find yourself despising, you know, and the phrase in any state can remind us that folks are in pain, folks are suffering, folks are manifesting a certain kind of action based on the conditions they grew up in, that they were raised in, that the culture gave them, that they're in a certain state. It'd be sort of like saying, you know, something like, you know, I'll go back to children because it's hard to despise them. Yeah, but I don't know. Say you're at a toddler birthday party, and the birthday person is being a total jerk. It's just like charging around, hitting people, doing something, whatever. And you're just like, oh, I hate that kid. Which, you know, you would never. I know you would never say, but you know, some people would say such a thing. I don't know. like, I hate that kid. You know, they're such a whatever. And then you're like, oh, they're totally overstimulated. They've been given way too much sugar, and they're kind of flipping out. They missed their nap, like whatever. I know what it's like to have a kid who's you know, overtired, overstimulated, melting down. As soon as you understand that, you don't despise them, right? You're just like, oh, sweetie, you're a mess. Right, you're melting down. You missed your nap. You shouldn't have had 3 pieces of cake. I know you wanted it. It's your birthday, whatever. But you're a mess. It's easy to see it in toddlers. It's not so easy to see it in adults. In like somebody in your life who's just difficult, who's in a sense spilling out their suffering onto others. But what if you could say, oh, they're in a state. They're in a state that was the product of conditions. And the implication for this is that it's, at least in some ways, not their fault. Even if they put themselves in that state, even if they're, you know, they're an alcoholic and they're drunk, and you're just like, stop being an alcoholic. But you're like, no, it's a state. It's a state that comes from conditions. What would it be like to not despise anybody in any state, even if they're in a terrible state of fear or contraction, and doing terrible things because of it? So let none deceive another or despise any being. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. I like that this whole section is in the passive voice. Let none. What does that mean? And that's the English translation. We can get into translation issues, but I like the passive voice in it. It's like someone said this a couple weeks ago. It's generous. It doesn't feel like a commandment or something like you must do it this way. But there's a let. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. And again, this is almost the most poisonous result of differentiation or duality, is that in their confusion, in a suffering state, beings sometimes wish harm on another being. This is considered to be one of the deepest of the wounds on the psyche or on the heart in the Buddhist system, ill will, hatred. And the practice of radiating kindness will inevitably at some point meet up with or bump up against hatred or ill will in your own heart. This is a purification practice. As we do it, we're like, may everybody be well. And if I keep doing that, at some point I'm going to be like, oh, but I have anger. I have fear. I have hatred in my heart. And we'll find it. It'll show up because it can't persist if you keep doing this practice. You keep intending to love everybody, and at a certain point you're going to be like, but I don't. Damn it. And then you have to deal with that. You have to actually be present with ill will, which is a terrible feeling. But it's a feeling, like all feelings, that's the result of conditions. Hatred is generally a result of hatred. So then I can feel into my own system, my family system, my cultural system, and I can say, you know, that I was taught in a way to hate. This is core in the kind of unlearning, you know, racism and bias teachings, that children are taught to hate those that are different from them. It doesn't come naturally. So we will come upon these aspects of ourselves that are not pretty, but that are also possible to transform or release once we can see them clearly, and we come upon them as we undertake this practice. How do you work with anger and ill will and hatred? Let's just look for a little bit here, finishing kind of the talk part and coming into some discussion, but let's think for a moment or feel for a moment for yourself into this quality of ill will or hatred or anger. They're different. These kind of point to different things. What is it that closes your heart down to someone? I'm just sensing for yourself both what are perhaps some of the conditions in which that happens, and also a little bit just even the memory of what that feels like. What it feels like to despise someone. Even if you have a moment of this in your history somewhere, what it may have felt like to wish harm, to wish that someone else would hurt. This isn't about, you know, beating ourselves up at all, but just seeing clearly this thing that's profoundly human and painful, and shining the light of loving awareness on it. So even as you reflect, you're holding your own life and your system and your story with this kindness. You too are a product of conditions. What do you notice? What is this quality of ill will or hatred in yourself? If anyone's willing to be, you know, a little vulnerable and share, these are human qualities that are part of the human experience. There's no shame in in having these qualities arise in one's mind stream. It's impossible in a world full of trauma and abuse for them not to arise. They're appropriate in certain ways. What do you notice about them as you reflect? Yeah.
seems like when I'm in a situation where, like, I want something and I don't get it, like, for example, at work, like, petty cabbing, like, if an Uber driver is, like, in the bike lane and I can't get through, or, like, if I'm traveling and I'm having problems, like, at the border, like, that will make me angry. And if it's a person, like, kind of, like, hurts my ego on top of it, like, laughs at me or, like, enjoys my suffering, I get angry. I feel hatred towards the person. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think it is? Is it like a sort of ego level thing? Like I have a kind of pride, or what's happening in your kind of psychic system that quality is what comes to the fore?
I think a lot of it is ego, like feeling like laughed at by somebody when I'm angry, when I'm like feeling justified, like
yeah,
and then to have someone laugh at me is like that's just like too much, like I get so.
Yeah.
Kind of angry, like, how dare you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really angry, and I, like, this is frustrating, can't you see?
Yeah.
And I mean, those are, like, not things that are actually that bad. I have to stop for a while, and, like, you know, it's not that big a deal, but in the moment, like, it's, like...
Well, it's cognitively not that big a deal, because you're a mature adult, but the physiology still responds,
yeah.
Right? The kind of, the heat arises, the kind of,
Yeah.
Arises. I have some of the same when I'm being prevented from doing something that I want, right? And again, this has happened at borders for me or you know, various things. It happens for me with, you know, police and other kinds of authority. I'm not good with authority, which is to be, you know. And so, like, what is that? It's like, there's some way that, like, I bump up against a boundary that's like a human boundary, not just like a technical impossibility. It's okay if, like, I want to do something and I'm not personally capable of doing it. Like, I really want to play, you know, the Beethoven Piano Sonata Opus 111, but I can't. And so then I'm not mad, right? I'm just like, I just can't. Didn't practice enough, you know. But when it's like, you know, some authority person that's like, no, you can't go in there or do this thing, this, like, heat boils up. It's like, oh, I'm so mad. And so there is some kind of, like, insult to the ego that I can feel. Like, oh, I just, you know, I don't want any human to stand in my way, basically. Especially in things that feel sort of arbitrary to me. So there's something in ego and kind of self-righteousness. Like the Uber drivers, you know.
Man, those Uber drivers. So they, oh man, they're, I hope no one here drives their Uber.
One of the amazing things that hatred does is it generalizes to groups, right? This is how discrimination works.
Actually, I had an experience recently. I was talking to a friend of mine, and he's homeless. He's under the Bolognero statue in San Francisco. And he's a friend, and we were chatting, and I was making some comment about, like, seeing, like, homeless people in San Francisco and, like, how they've gotten, like, more, you know, like, there's some, like, really intense situations that I see sometimes working down the waterfront. And I realized as I said it, like, the way I say homeless, I'm referring to some, like, specific attributes that are, like, really, like, out there in, like, a subsection of homeless people and saying that to someone who's homeless. Like realizing how I was saying it in, like, a negative way, I was really, like, shocked because I realized, like, I was including him in this, like, category of people, and I realized, like, it's, like, this category that I often talk about without having to, like, watch what I'm saying and, like, watch my assumptions. And,
yeah.
Like, and I was really, yeah, it was an eye-opener because I thought,
yeah.
It was, like,
yeah, it's a good moment when we realize that we have had some kind of blind spot. Like, oh, I can talk about these folks because I don't know any, or I'm not talking to any. But, you know, to actually be speaking to a real live human being who is a member of a kind of a group that I might make a generalization about.
Yeah. And I was implying things by saying homeless.
Yeah.
Relaying.
good feeling. It's an important feeling anyway. It's not comfortable. What else do you notice? Hatred and overwhelm. Yeah.
A bit about the Beethoven piano sonata brought up a really visceral memory in me, actually, of being a little boy.
What, like you can play it?
No.
I hate you.
I remember being a little kid and practicing piano and not being able to do something and being like filled with utter rage and like throwing my arms onto the piano to just like cause some kind of destruction or something,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's interesting that like this extreme aversion, like, did it just manifest in this like violence, basically? I mean, fortunately, it was for a piano, not a person.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it's interesting. It's, you know, little you is frustrated, right? We would say like, oh, you want to be able to do something, you can't do it yet. You're frustrated. When the text talks about, you know, these poisons of like anger and ill will and hatred, you know, it's always with a living person at the other end of it. So is it the same quality? And is the living person at the other end of it actually yourself? Like, I'm angry at myself for not being able to do this in some way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in those situations it was at myself. But I also remember, like, if somebody, like my mom would come and be like, what's wrong? I would, like, get projected at her.
Yeah.
You know, because of the, and then there's, like, an embarrassment.
Yeah.
And it kind of like feels, you know, can feel itself that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. I remember getting so mad and just being like, I'm just looking around for something to kick. I'm just like, piano? No. Wall? And it's kick something. And it's like, you know. Yeah. What else? What else in these states? Hatred. Despising.
I could be very controlling out of fear, and so then when I don't get what I want, I manipulate, and then I feel really contracted inside that I manipulated and I actually did that. So I go, so I'm going through this thing now where I'm trying to be vulnerable with something that I don't like, but I know if I manipulate, I'll just feel yucky.
Mm-hmm.
So I just like try and feel it. Like, it's playing out mostly with my youngest son, because I'm just trying to not have like desires or manipulate or direct and just like be with the situation.
Challenging,
and
right?
It's hard, but it feels like more ethical. To just like take care of me instead of trying to do something that will fix somebody else. But it's just trying to always come back to that. It's hard.
It is hard. Do you feel like it gives you a different kind of space in yourself that you're not doing all this stuff?
I feel happier in myself. You know, when I manipulate, I feel really sick inside myself.
Yeah.
So when I do this, when I can. And I was interested how you talk about discrimination and rebate in connection to all this, because like I know that I've played that tape so many times where I'll have an intention and I'll try and manipulate or subtly do something and then I'll see, I wasn't like totally clean and I'll feel bad. So when I don't do it and I can hold on, it's really hard. I'll feel like so like good and wise and like I'm a bigger space.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's kind of like addictive. So I'm really trying to work on it. Meditation helps too.
Yeah.
But it's over and over, same thing. I learn again.
Totally. You really have to see that part of the self that goes like, oh, I just want it. And you know, I'm just going to, if I just do this, I'll get it, you know. Yeah. Other thoughts here?
I can think of a really specific one right now, which is it makes me want that person to hurt. And and as I'm thinking it through to like articulate it here, it's like, well, somehow if they hurt equal as they hurt me, because, and it has to be because they hurt me, and it has to be with remorse, then somehow it in my twisted mind it feels like that will make my hurt less, you know, like that.
Yeah. I mean, in your twisted mind, or just like part of human cultures forever, like, you know, the old law, an eye for an eye, that was a literal, you know, kind of compensatory sort of justice idea, goes way, way, way back in many different cultures, that, you know, the punishment should match the crime, that the criminal should be punished in a way that balanced out the harmful thing that they did, and that somehow that kind of balances the scales, you know. And this is where revenge killings, you know, come from. And there are still cultures in the world where if someone hurts someone in your family, you know, the honorable thing to do, in some frameworks, is to for someone from your family to go and hurt someone in their family at about the same amount of hurt. And so this is a really, because this idea shows up in lots of different places, it's a really ancient idea, we can feel into like, yeah, what is that quality in us that would want that? That would feel like, oh, that'll do it. That'll sort of make it okay. If, you know, if that person kind of is hurt in the same sort of way, or in a way that will somehow balance. So I don't think it's twisted at all. I think it's actually kind of instinctual in some way. And then we could just look at what the effect of that quality in the heart-mind is, and what it might mean to practice letting go of revenge, basically. To be like, oh, they hurt me because of the state they were in, because of conditions, and I'm going to work on forgiving rather than getting revenge. And I'm sure that consciously or cognitively, that's where you would go. But to notice that, maybe. But to notice that quality in the heart of just like, you know, it's really, it's shameful even internally sometimes to notice, oh, I have ill will toward this person. Like, I want them to suffer. You know, even if it's for a great reason. You know, they did this terrible thing. So again, I think it's valuable just to notice it and to kind of taste it a little bit. All of these things, I think, are you know, like Hannah was saying, if you actually sense them or feel them, they're painful in us. Even though if we're not really sensing them, they can feel kind of satisfying. Like, oh, I'll just get them back, and that'll do it. And then and a deeper layer, it's like, oh, that really hurts. And the encouragement here is to feel the hurt. Essentially, and be willing to do something else, love them anyway, essentially, which is hard.
Yeah, I just have to say, because I had a reaction that time, and also earlier when you were talking about it, it's sort of like if you understand why someone is the way they are,
yep,
then that brings empathy and compassion, right. And I'm a psychologist, and I understand oftentimes why people have formed into who they are.
Yeah.
And I still think we're each accountable for putting out what we put out into the world. I don't think it's an
absolutely
excuse to, like,
it's no excuse at all
to other people.
Yeah, it's no excuse at all. That's always the important thing on this, like, understanding conditions thing, is people cause harm because of the conditions that they're under, because they're unenlightened, because they were harmed, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't mean they're not responsible for their actions, you know, or that we shouldn't hold folks accountable. It's interesting. So here's the story of the famous serial killer that's part of the Buddhist early stories. So this is the story of Angulimala, and he was a guy who for for various reasons, and some say he was deceived into doing this, but who made a vow to kill 1,000 people, and he would cut off their fingers and wear them as a garland, a necklace. So angulis are fingers, and mala is the necklace. So garland of fingers was his name. And the text says that he killed 999 people, and for the 1,000th, he thought he would kill this old monk who was walking through the woods. The Buddha had been wandering in this one area, and people had said, oh, don't go in those woods. This terrible killer is in there, Angulimala, he'll totally kill you. So the Buddha, of course, goes in there, and Angulimala says, oh, this old man, he'll be my 1,000th killing. And the Buddha is walking along slowly and mindfully, and he performs a little bit of superpower magic, where even though he's walking along really slowly and Angulimala is running after him with his weapons, Angulimala can't catch him. He keeps running and running and can't catch the Buddha. And finally, Angulimala says, you know, old man, stop. And the Buddha turns around and he says, Angulimala, I stopped a long time ago. Now you stop. And the text says that hearing that the quality in which the Buddha said it kind of broke through the haze of whatever had been kind of hypnotizing him in such a bad way. And he, fell at the Buddha's feet, said, you know, I've done all these terrible things. Can you accept me as a monk? And the Buddha says, yes, I'll accept you. And takes him into the community of monks. And it says that within a couple weeks of practicing, he becomes fully enlightened. He does strong, good practice. He becomes liberated. So he's a monk, he's an arhant, he's fully liberated. He's walking on alms through the town, but people know who he is still. It's not like he suddenly was not Angulimala the serial killer. And so people throw rocks and clumps of dirt and sticks at him, and he comes back from his alms round bleeding and wounded. And he goes to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, bear it, monk, bear it. This is the natural result of your actions. And there's this way that even though he has been forgiven and he's gotten liberated, he still must in some ways receive the karmic result of his actions. It's appropriate that people are mad at him, basically, for killing all those people. And so he's instructed to in a sense tolerate the relatively minor harm that's being done to him. Because it's a result of the harm that he did. So I like that there's the sense in it that that it's both possible to change your path from being having a terrible path, and that it's appropriate to still be, you know, held accountable for your action. I mean, having clumps of dirt thrown at you after you killed 990 people, maybe it's a relatively minor sort of held accountable. Like, it doesn't quite match up. But there is the sense that his karma follows him even beyond liberation. So it's really important, the piece that you're bringing in of, like, we are responsible for our actions. It's important to hold people accountable. And then some paradox of, like, how can we do that and still, like, not cast them out of our heart? Or, you know, forgive them but still hold them accountable has to be at the heart of this practice. If it's going to include everybody, it has to include all the worst people. So I'm glad you bring it in. It's important in this spot to include that piece. But what else? Or anything on that particular piece even, because that one's challenging, the accountability while maintaining the open heart thing.
It's not on what we've been talking about. It's more about, you talked about told us to get in touch with these feelings that are maybe coming up when we're showing hate or grudge towards each other. But for me, it's so hard to, like, I'm able to experience feelings, but when I'm, like, trying to feel them or get in touch with them, it's like there's just something holding me back, or there's, like, I'm, like, not able to experience anything of that. I'm wondering how is it so separated, or how is it more easy to get in touch?
Well, yeah, I mean, these kinds of feelings are all state-specific. So, you know, if ill will or hatred in some way comes along with the feeling, say, of feeling threatened or not safe or judged, you're not really going to be able to invoke the feeling and sense it unless you're also in that state, unless you, like, consciously, you know, brought to mind, like, a moment when you felt threatened or judged and really remembered, you know, where you were and who you were with and what you were doing. And then the state will come back. And you'll be like, oh, yeah, and then I felt this. So feelings are state-specific in that way. So, and all of the feelings are like that. Like, if I said, like, you know, remember what it was like to feel in love, you can't just abstractly feel in love. You'd have to, like, think of a person or a situation that you were in where you felt that, and then the feeling could re-arise. But it's about context.
I would disagree with that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Cool.
I think you absolutely associate and experience feelings without a context or without a purpose.
Uh-huh.
Particularly if it's a repetitive emotion or connection.
Yeah.
That you've experienced in many different situations.
Yeah.
I do think it's something that you need to be in touch with, and that doesn't necessarily help how do you get there.
Right, right.
But I think context helps these arise, and we associate them very strictly to context.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're isolated to it.
Yeah, that's awesome. What would be an example? Like, how would I do that?
I don't know. Your example of experiencing love, you need to think of a person or an experience in particular. I don't agree with that at all.
Cool.
I maybe it's just because I'm fortunate and I consider I'm quite open and I love other people.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm just open to that particular sensation, and that's
right.
Why I think this. But I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about fear and anxiety and a lot of kind of pent-up energies.
Yeah.
And I think we've all listed many different scenarios in which those exist, and we've all been able to seemingly agree upon them without knowing the person in the context of the situation. And we can still all together experience what that person is going through and understand it and relate to it and have empathy towards it without fully getting the context.
Yeah, totally. No, I like that. There's some way that this one thing you said about, like you're really familiar with something. It's like, oh, if I really know this feeling, then maybe I don't need specific context to reinvoke it because I'm so used to it. I should be like, oh, I just know what that feels like. That makes sense to me. You can go there. Yeah, I like the familiarity piece. Yeah, right?
There's like a monthly cycle where I feel feelings that aren't necessarily contextual, even though my mind will turn them into contextual.
Of course.
I don't think it comes from my mind. I think it comes from my biology.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to throw that in.
Well, that's great. It's almost like that's the context rather than an interpersonal context. When you're not in that moment in your hormonal cycle, can you reinvoke those feelings? Could you, like, remember what that was like? You're like, oh, yeah.
To a minor extent.
Yeah.
Like, I think kind of what you were saying before was a little bit like, I just can't quite feel it. And I think it's because it's becoming from your mind instead of coming from your body.
Sure.
And your body is so much more an intense apparatus to feel with than your mind is.
Totally.
But I think if you meditate on it long enough, you can invoke strong feelings with your
ego. Yeah. Yeah. I bet you could. I mean, I know what my strong feelings feel like. And it's interesting. Now I'm thinking about this thing that you're bringing in, and I'm like, would I really? The thing about something being state specific is it's a little different from it being situation specific. So, like, if I want to think about feeling in love, I might think about a specific person, but I might. What else would I do if I didn't do that? There is some way that what I might try to do is just remember the bodily feeling outside of the context. And that I can do. I would call that a still state specific. I'm invoking a state, but it's not content specific. And maybe that's important. And that I can do. And that I imagine that you could do, you know, in meditation. You could be like, okay, let me remember that volatile, you know, state that... this is actually talked about in the commentaries. We'll stop. This is totally a footnote. This is talked about in the commentaries as why insight that comes from vipassana is more permanently transformative than the states of mind that are associated with samadhi or concentration, because the states are supposedly, this is in the commentaries, they say anyway, they really only have power while you're in them, where insights can be remembered later and can have power in an ongoing way. So that's a curious distinction, that like there's some experiences that are really potent while you're in them, and when you're not in them, they're kind of a sort of outline of themselves, but not really punchy. And there's others that, like, once you have the experience, it continues to affect you, even if you're not in that kind of moment itself. Gwen, and then we'll stop.
That actually just reminds me of, like, when I have migraines, there's, like, various things that I've thought, like, I'll try to do, but I, like, forget, like, when I don't have a migraine, I forget, like, how awful it is, and, like, I think, this is when I was on meditation retreat, I wanted to, I was really determined to, like, try to, like, meditate through it, like, not, like, sit in meditation, but, like, just, like, maintain awareness and not, like, slide off into just being in pain. And I couldn't, and I never was able to manage it. And I always thought, like, I would be able to, but I couldn't remember how awful it was to have a migraine. Like, that was just something that, like, I would think, like, oh, no, like, if my will is strong enough, but I couldn't, like, quite fully bring myself back to, like, remembering, like, no, it's actually that bad. Like, I couldn't. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, it's like a state that I couldn't call back and, like, remember what it would be like and, like, accurately figure out, like, how I could respond in that situation.
Totally.
Yeah.
That was my experience getting dengue fever in Burma. Oh. I was like, I'm totally doing intensive vipassana. It's just a sensation. And I'd be like, it's just a sensation. And then my whole being would go like, I hate it. And I'm like, why are you doing that? It's just a sensation. Practice, man. And I'd be like, I can't, I hate it. Like, I wasn't able to do it.
Yeah.
It was totally, it was terrible. Okay, migraines and dengue, hatred and ill will. A fun time was had by all. Thank you for being here. Welcome to new folks. Really lovely to meet you and have you here. And your generosity sustains the group. Donations can go in the box or at the desk. And... enjoy whatever this season is for you. We'll continue with the Metta Sutta next week. We'll get to do look at the beautiful metaphor at the center, or simile at the center of the thing, to love everyone even as a mother loves her only child. So talk about maternal love next time. So blessings to all of y'all and everyone everywhere. May you be well. See you soon.